Hey, this is John Hyams, and you're listening to Dark Discussions, and we're talking today about season two of Black Summer on Netflix, and I'm currently working on a feature for Miramax, written and produced by Kevin Williamson, called Sick, and it will be it's a horror movie that will be coming out in 22, and then a bunch of other things hopefully to be coming in that year.
The reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum. Oh,
my name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from here. Stay away from here. I'm coming here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello, welcome to the Dark Discussions News Network. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And in the Commonwealth of Virginia?
Hey, this is Barrett.
Barrett, how's it going?
Going well.
Excellent. All right, so we are here, a special episode, a very important person to the genre community because of how great his work is, specifically what we're going to talk about tonight. Let's introduce him. And why don't you introduce yourself and let everybody know who you are?
My name is John Hyams. I'm the director and the co-creator, showrunner of the show Black Summer, which is in season two. And I think that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit today.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a brand new show that season two just appeared on the Netflix station where people can go check it out, stream it, and binge it because it all came out at one time. The last time we talked to you was when you were talking about your film Alone, and you were actually filming some of this show here. So that was kind of interesting that now we brought you on it's almost a year or so now. But either way, we got a bunch of questions for you, and my co-hosts do as well. So let's start with Barrett, because we'll go alphabetical order by first name.
All right. The first thing I wanted to say is this season two is one of the best seasons of television I've ever watched of just about any show ever. It's amazing.
Oh, thank you.
And for my question, it feels like – is there like a time span between season one and season two where some things happen that we don't see? Because it feels like Naziri has some things against Rose at the very end that we haven't seen. So I just get this feeling like there's a time span that things happen that we're not privy to.
Well, there is a time span. I think that, the first idea that I came up with for doing a season two was that I wanted to change the environment that the characters were dealing with so that there was a definitive, even visual difference between seasons one and two, that you could watch any part of either season and know what season you're in just by the landscape. And season one, we really focused on the breakdown of urban and suburban communities, and that it was generally set in those regions. And I felt like season two should, you know, an interesting thing to bring into it would be to bring make surviving the elements a big part of the story. You know, some of my favorite pieces of cinema have often involved that kind of thing. I think when we talked about Alone, you know, I often thought about Deliverance, you know, which was a kind of man versus man, man versus nature type of story. And when we first started talking about a season two of Black Summer, the things that came to my mind immediately were, I thought about William Friedkin's Sorcerer, and the original Wages of Fear that it was based on. But Sorcerer was very much about this kind of suicide mission where the elements were as challenging as the individuals. I thought about The Treasure of Sierra Madre, and I thought about John Carpenter's The Thing. You know, those were the first three things that hit me, and I felt like we shoot in Calgary, Alberta. Let's take advantage of the landscape and the winter. So this is a long answer to your question, but that it, you know, the, it kind of falls into that. When the first decision was made to set this during the winter, then suddenly we had to accept that, okay, there's going to be a gap in time from where we left off season one to where season two came. And to me, that was really interesting. I mean, sometimes it's interesting to start a second season like the moment after season one ends. I mean, that's a decision right there. But I always liked the idea, and I think Black Summer is very much about this. I love the idea of negative space, you know, and the sense that there's a gap that happened between the end of the last season, the beginning of the next one, and that we can fill in that gap without actually explaining it in expository terms. You can see what the characters look like when we return to them and know that something happened, you know, a story was told that we're missing. I mean, and I think that very much is in the spirit of the show, where we kind of show you and we don't tell you, and you fill in the gaps, and that's part of involving the audience and, to me, respecting the audience. And so in saying that, we decided let's have one episode, which is episode two of this season, where you get a vignette of backstory for everybody. You know, season two, which is called Prelude, I mean, episode two, which is called Prelude, we then go back and show you just basically a scene from each of the main characters that shows you, kind of gives you a hint as to what got them to here. And, you know, Nazari has his own bit. We meet him as somewhat of a morally dubious and somewhat, you know, almost sadistic, villainous character, but we present him in a different way in that episode. So so I think the short answer is the point of starting it, you know, of leaving that gap, A, was to take advantage of just this different environment, throwing the characters into that, having them battle the elements as well as battling the humans, as well as battling the, you know, the monster threat. And then the other part of that is that it allowed us to kind of advance the story of what has happened to humanity by several months' time, and how has humanity, the attitude of humanity, changed in that time. And that's kind of what we focus a lot on in this season, is what is the state of humanity? How are we, have we entered the dark ages? How are we dealing with each other? And will we survive this? Not just the infection threat, but will we survive each other and our own most base instincts?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, nice. I like how Nazari is, because he like you said, he's kind of dubious, but then we see him in his real life, or right as the apocalypse is happening, and then that open up the final episode of the season. He has a great line that sums everything up, where he's making himself either feeling foolish himself, as well as all the other people that, you know, he could have made deals with and become friends with and whatnot, and no one needed to die. Everybody could have got on a plane. But either way, Mike, you have a question.
I got a bunch, but first, I'm just curious, before I get to my real question, where is this? You mentioned to film this in Calgary. Where is this supposed to be actually set? Is that also supposed to be set there?
It's not. I mean, it's supposed to be set in the United States, and we don't define actually exactly where it is. You know, it could be Colorado, Montana, Wyoming. You know, it could be a place like that. I mean, it the idea in season one was, you know, America, a refugee crisis in the country of America. So. And we feel like it's a story about America in many ways, but we wanted to leave it somewhat undefined, and not in the name of being vague, but in the name of allowing it to feel like, certainly in season one, I wanted to feel like it's your town, it's your city, it's any city, it's that there's something very relatable about this residential area where things are taking place, and even this urban center, that it could feel like any city, and that we're telling a very universal story.
Okay, thank you. So the actual question I wanted to get to, I think one of the things that makes this show unique is the way, and the first season as well, is the way you structure the story. I'll be honest, I'm in the middle of my second watch. I just finished rewatching episode 4. And a lot of stuff, because you just drop us in media res right at the beginning of as you said before. So there were a lot of things that made a lot more sense to me, I think, on a second rewatch, because so much comes at you and there's a lot of new characters and new events. Not that I ever necessarily felt lost, but the connections started really clicking into place on the second viewing. How do you craft a story like that? I mean, it's do you start writing out a straightforward narrative and then go back and edit it and change the structure? It's very much like a Pulp Fiction-y kind of structure too.
Yeah. I agree that I think one, you know, again, in many cases, you know, the form follows the function of this. And so one of the first decisions that was made in Black Summer in terms of what the form would be was that we wanted the show to play in real time, that every chapter of Black Summer plays in real time, and it sticks with a single point of view, meaning that means a couple things. Number one, we never compress time. There's no montages in Black Summer. We can never advance time to, you know, cut from one moment to 20 minutes later or a day later. Every vignette is real time, and the point of view stays singular. So we can never cut behind the door. If someone is at a door, we can't let you see what's happening behind that door. You experience everything from the point of view of the character, so that the audience is in the same, dealing with the same mystery that the characters are dealing with. So because that was a decision that, you know, that was one of the first decisions made about how to do this show, then the question becomes, well, how do you see what's behind the door? If we can't cut behind the door and shows you who was on the other side of the door, what's the best way to reveal something that our character doesn't know? The best way to reveal it is through another chapter from somebody else's perspective. And then suddenly, when you realize, okay, we're going to be dealing with multiple perspectives. Then you start to think about, all right, well, now we can have a lot of fun with a non-linear timeline, because we can present something that is a mystery and then answer it in a later chapter by showing you what happened before. And, you know, in season one, we explored this non-linear timeline many different times. But, you know, in the first episode, we kind of showed you a period of time that was repeated from multiple characters' perspectives. And we used the sound of these jets flying overhead and an explosion happening to let you know you're hearing the same time frame over and over. In season two, because, again, we were, as we said and discussed in the previous question, we're going to be moving considerably far ahead in time. And I think the fun of that is to kind of put the audience in a place where there's a lot of mystery and they have a lot of questions. And then, but they know, hopefully from watching the show, that those questions are going to be answered in an interesting way. So one of the things we did in episode one of the season is you meet a whole bunch of new characters and we're dealing with a very different environment. And then in one of the final chapters of the episode, we finally meet kind of our main protagonist from season one, which is Rose, played by Jamie King. And we see her in a house in the middle of nowhere, and the house is full of dead bodies. So immediately that raises a question, like, what the hell happened to that house? And now that already leads to a really fun thing where in the, you know, at the end of the next episode, we can have her enter that house and see a bunch of people. And we know they're all going to probably die. And then episode three is going to be, well, what happened in the house? So it's almost like we're giving you little kernels of information early on. We're presenting a mystery, and the mystery can only be solved by going back in time. But rather than using flashback devices, or rather than having somebody talk about it, we have people kind of talk around it and kind of hopefully generate your interest. You know, Rose talks about, you know, everybody's died. They screwed up. If everyone behaved, we'd be all right, but they didn't. And this is what's happening now. And so that by writing that dialogue, that makes me as an audience want to know what the hell happened in there. And, you know, you mentioned Pulp Fiction. I mean, you know, Tarantino was the thing that excited me about Tarantino when he first came on was, among other things, just the way he structured, and take Reservoir Dogs as an example, right? It's a bunch of guys in a warehouse talking about a heist gone wrong, you know, and now we're going to slowly put together throughout the course of the movie what the hell happened in the heist. It's not about, you know, most heist movies, they plan the heist, like the killing or something, and then it goes wrong. Reservoir Dogs, we know it went wrong, and now we're going to find out what went wrong and what was the cause. And so that's just, to me, always a really satisfying narrative device if it's done right, you know, if you pull it off, is seeing the result and then going back and finding what led you there. And so we try to make that as much as much a kind of signature element of the show as anything else. To me, the structure is ultimately, you know, what makes me most interested in Black Summer, what we're doing, and, you know, how we plan it out. Yes, I think in general we come up with the basics of the linear story, but at the same time, you also might say, you know, we also might have ideas like, you know, you come into a house of dead bodies, what happened there? And then we have to, you know, write ourselves into a corner and figure out what happened in there. I don't exactly remember what the order was when we came up with that one, but I think a lot of it is, you know, is planting seeds. I remember hearing Vince Gilligan talking about writing a Breaking Bad, because Breaking Bad, when you watch those seasons, it feels like they wrote the entire thing before ever starting it, because it just was so perfect in the way it all went together. But Vince Gilligan said, you know, we would just plant seeds for us, plant seeds for ourselves that we knew we'd have to figure out later, like the ricin planted in the wall socket. Like, we didn't know how the ricin was going to be used. We just put it in there and knew it was going to pay off later, you know? So part of that is just kind of coming up with these ideas that, that can be paid off. And so that's, to me, that's just part of the, you know, that I enjoy that type of storytelling.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. A quick one, like Mike had first, and then the main question. The quick question is, since Jamie King is one of Taylor Swift's best friends, will you ever be able to get her, Taylor Swift, in a cameo for season 3?
Obsessed.
If she wants to be in season 3, I'm you know, happy to come up with a character for her. That would be pretty fun.
You could have her play Taylor Swift. She could survive.
Taylor Swift probably would have the means to survive at all. She'd probably be in on an island somewhere, very well guarded.
Yeah, just ask Jamie King. She could probably set it up for you. But yeah, anyway, my real question. Yeah, do it. Absolutely. So my real question is the basically we follow the characters on the show as if we're right behind them. This makes it feel like, you know, we are fully immersed in their world. And with your long shots, meaning when I say long shots, I'm sure that's the wrong term, but shots that aren't cut. So you have a camera and you just go for a long length of time. It was effective, obviously, at the beginning of the first episode with Lance. But then my favorite ones were with Anna while she's walking along the lodge. And you know, we hear the atmosphere. So you're using sound as well as what we see when we watch this. So my question is how did you get that idea to do that? Because I've never seen a television show do that before. And it's like other zombie shows. I mean, this is almost found footage without found footage too, there with the characters. How did you get that idea to go about doing that?
Well, that was a byproduct of the idea of putting it in real time, you know? So by saying it's going to be in real time, there's really no better way to portray real time than by actually having an unbroken take, because while cutting doesn't always compress time, it is a way of compressing time, and by letting the shot play, you're experiencing it in, it's almost like a piece of theater at that time, or a video game for that matter, in the sense that you are existing with the characters in time that you're not compressing. I would also just say that I've found there's certain filmmakers that have been very influential on me aesthetically. Specifically, in my goal with Black Summer was to make it a suspense thriller. You know, that was what I wanted. I wanted to take the zombie genre and make it into a suspense thriller. And so when I look to some of the people who are the best at that, even though they may not be known for suspense thrillers, there's a couple of filmmakers. One is Michael Haneke, who's an great Austrian filmmaker, and another guy's named Gaspar Noé. And both of those filmmakers, I used to, you know, watch them a lot, you know, over 10, 15 years ago, and really studied their films. And what I learned from them is that they really would use the device of a long shot, or not cutting for that matter, as a means of holding the audience in suspense. And I realized, especially someone, you know, I'm an editor myself and I have an editing background, and you know, the more I edited, the more I wanted to cut less. And I think because I realized that a cut can be done very impatiently, and it can be almost an act of it can be an act of cowardice on the part of the filmmaker, afraid that you're not going to be interested in paying attention, so we better cut to another angle. And I see a lot of impatient cutting, certainly in network television and things like that, where they're just really afraid that the audience is not going to be able to watch a sustained shot of a person walking to a door and knocking on the door. If you watch network television, that might be four shots to tell that simple story. But if you watch everyone from Michael Haneke to Gaspar Noé to Steven Spielberg, for that matter, you know, there's confidence in these, in that type of filmmaking. Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, people who know the suspense of holding a shot. Who's that?
Vince Gilligan for Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, another good example.
For sure, yeah. If they're very patient, so that when there is a cut, because there's nothing wrong with a cut, and cuts are very effective, and we have them in the show, but they should feel very intentional, and they should be the cut. When there is a cut, you're really saying something. So we use the long take as a way of keeping you in suspense, maintaining this real-time feeling, and allowing you. I mean, people have talked about Black Summer before and said that there is a tension to things that are happening. And I think a lot of that tension really has to do with the people are expecting a cut and it's not coming, and they're being held almost to the point of discomfort. And then something can, you know, now you have them in suspense, and then you can utilize all the tricks of suspense, you know, filmmaking, which is misdirection and, you know, like you say, using audio. I mean, that's a really big element of it, because if we are existing in a single perspective, what's happening around the characters and what's happening in other rooms of the lodge, or battles that are raging on a different floor or blocks away, we could use audio to paint this picture for you of basically telling a story of things that are happening not on camera. And that's something that my sound designer, Neil Fazzari, and I have talked a lot about, is that there's other stories going on, and some of those stories are happening with the audio. I mean, there are, in some of those battles in episode one and episode four, for instance, they have entire storylines that are happening purely through audio, where you hear a person yelling at another person and then a gunshot, and one of those people turns into a zombie, and then you hear them chasing around, and then the other person's attacked, and then someone comes in and deals with that. And the sound team is dealing with these multiple narratives that are happening simultaneously, and it's all just kind of filling out this immersive world that you're thrust into the middle of. So audio is as important, if not more important, than the visuals in this show particularly. Nice. And by the way, the term that people in production use for the long take is they call those oneers. You know, that's when you do a oneer, that's like Scorsese in the Copacabana, you know, at Goodfellas. That's a right. Famous oneer right there.
Yes. All right, Barrett, what do you got?
So you have some pretty amazing set pieces in this show. Did those just happen? Were they happenstance, or did you have specific locations in mind, like the lodge and the mansion specifically are kind of pretty amazing locations for filming?
You know, so the lodge, for instance, was a location that we had looked at for season one. When we were scouting season one, originally episode three of season one, which takes place in a school, was supposed to take place in an abandoned hotel. And then our location manager showed us those schools, and we thought the school was actually really interesting, and let's use the school as an environment. And also, in season one, we really wanted familiar settings. We wanted to focus on more familiar things. So we uh, So we went with the school season one, but I remembered that location, and I remembered especially because when we had scouted at season one, it was winter time, and it just had this very eerie kind of Overlook Hotel feel to it. And so season two, we thought, okay, we need to have the care about showing just how difficult it would be to take one of these things down, so that really most of the time you're just trying to get away from them. You don't want to fight them. You don't want to stop and try and shoot them. And we even had a scene in season two, in episode two, of showing someone trying to line up a scope over the head of a zombie and get a shot off. And, you know, it's not a deer that's standing still. It's something that's moving quickly and erratically, and really play that out. How hard would it be to get this shot off? So I think the goal is just to present it in as realistic a way as I and the rest of us could imagine, and all the awkwardness of that, how would that play out?
Yeah, I have an interesting question too, and my question is that a lot of the characters are ambiguous with their morals. So, you know, I've always said for these dystopian media that a character, when they find strangers, these strangers sometimes become like family in a sense, and as a result, they are folks you can trust with your life and whatnot, and people that you can work with and have set the same goals with. So you should never let those folks go when you find them, because in a world where people you can't trust and you already have a group that you can trust, you should hold on to them, you know, for as if they were your brother or sister or spouse. So, like example, so when we see some things here, which are Spears makes a decision about Bratworth. It may be wrong when he says something later in the Lodge episode, makes us think that maybe the decision that we saw on the screen was not the same decision as what actually happened. And then when Mance does what he does late in another episode, and possibly the most egregious, is when Rose has a moment, she has to make a decision about Sun and Spears, and even makes a decision later with Boone. Rose later explains why she made this decision to Spears in the Lodge episode, and it sounds valid, yet can be interpreted as short-sighted after what we've seen, and you know what I've said about how when you find people, you should always hold on to them. So we also see Nazari. You know, we see how he's become a person he would never otherwise have been, a person he actually used to arrest, is what kind of what he's become. And so by the end, with his monologue, and he talks about things, and it appears that he's seen the light. How was it writing and deciding to make these people very ambiguous and short-sighted sometimes, even though they think they're doing the right thing? How do you go about that?
Well, I think that that's really what the story of the season is that it's not to say that human beings are terrible, but it is to say that I think if we were faced with this type of situation, I think it's naive to think that we would instantly find a group of people and place our trust in that group of people. Because part of a survival instinct is to look out for yourself, your own interests. And if you feel those are threatened, you might cut bait, you might change allegiances, you know, and I think that that's something that, you know, those two concepts hang over not only humanity, but certainly America and our country, which is this a, you know, are we all in this together, or is this about the individual, you know, individualism versus thinking communally? Now, I think in this story and in season two, we made a point to have really only one single character consistently make decisions that were for other people and not selfish right. decisions. And everyone else is is faced with really tough decisions. You know, some of them are, very rarely are they being cruel and sadistic just for fun. It's always for survival purposes. And I'm not saying, as the person who's creating and writing these stories, that I'm above selfish decisions. I feel like, you know, the entire idea behind Black Summer was based on something, you know, a question that I posed to the writers and everyone else, which was, in cinema, we usually portray the idea of doing something for your child, to save your child, as a very heroic, venture. When in fact, it's actually not. It's survival. It's Darwinism. It's self-serving. And it's a decision I would make myself. And the way I posed it was, you know, a mother searching for her child. You know, you can look at that one way as like Liam Neeson in Taken, like, I got to find my daughter and I'm going to rip everybody a new one until I find her. Now, that could be a hero in one version of that story. But to me, that person could also become a version of a supervillain because their focus is so singular that everyone else is completely expendable in their mind. And the example I gave was sitting there. I said, okay, we're sitting in this restaurant here. Either your child lives or that person across the room lives. What's the choice? It's a very easy choice, right? My kid over that anonymous person. Okay, your child lives or that entire table, you know, or let's say your child dies or that entire table of four people over there, they die. What's your choice? I'll take the four back there. Let them go. Okay, your child dies or this entire restaurant, everyone in the restaurant, everyone else dies. What's your choice? Most people would still say their child. Okay, I'll take it a step further. Your child or 500,000 people across the globe. Which one do you choose? I mean, if you ask me and I'm being honest, I want my child to survive. Your child and 20 million anonymous people. And you can keep going with that. But it's our instinct to want to save our own child, our own family. So if you put that mentality out into the apocalypse, and you were there and you're trying to fight for your loved ones, are you going to do some morally ambiguous things at the expense of other people to save your tribe, yourself? A lot of people are going to do that. And then we present a character in Sun who makes very selfless decisions. And for a good part of the story, she's basically pays for those decisions. However, I think the ultimate statement of the show is that for humanity to survive, we need each other, and we actually need to be. Those selfish decisions are very short-sighted, and they actually don't lead to they don't really lead to the survival of the species. You know, the species survives when we are looking out for each other. However, it's important to present a very hopeless, in order to tell a story of hope, you have to present the most hopeless environment in the world and show how that may lead to short-term gain, but long-term loss, you know, and that's, so I think in many ways, that's the story we're trying to tell. It's not a nihilistic story, you know, it really isn't, but we are trying to be honest about the fact that every person would be forced to make a really, really difficult, morally ambiguous decision over and over and over, you know, and sometimes you have to make, in the case of Rose, preemptively morally ambiguous decisions. If her entire mission is, I'm just trying to keep my daughter alive, if someone like, you know, like the Boone character, if someone just gives you a bad feeling, maybe it's better I just take this person out and remove them from the equation than create this potential threat. And if everyone is thinking that way, that's a dangerous world to be in. And so that's what we wanted to represent. And I understand that it can seem incredibly harsh in the show, but there's a point behind it. It's not just, we're not reveling in the darkness. You know, we're trying to put the audience through something, and hopefully by the end they arrive in another place.
So my next question is about the environment they were acting in. It was very cold through most of this. Did that present any particular difficulties, or did the actors have a hard time? They all looked like they were suffering in this season. Yeah. That was really well done.
Well, I mean, in that case, you know, the environment was such that did a lot of work for them. You know, they don't have to act freezing because they are, it's uncomfortable. And that was in some ways the most fun part of the challenge to me. You know, I love when a movie or a show presents you a really challenging environment that feels real and doesn't feel like we, you know, faked. And it allows you to go through that. And I think, yeah, of course it was, that was the biggest challenge of the season. And shooting in that environment is really challenging. First of all, it's physically arduous to get to locations. You have to have snowmobiles, you know, and four wheelers bringing gear to and from places. You also, when you have snow and the characters run and trample through it, now we have to make that snow undisturbed again. So resets is really a challenge. And our visual effects team did a phenomenal job also of sometimes, you know, covering up the footprints during our resets and things like that. But yeah, that was kind of the point of the whole thing, like to make, you know, as I say, like Carpenter's The Thing. I mean, that you just felt the cold of that movie, and that was the tone, and that those punishing surroundings really inform the whole thing. And when you're staging, I mean, if you're an actor or a stunt person doing a fight, you know, doing a fight in the snow, in the rocks, in the dirt, I mean, it hurts more, you know, everything is tougher. And if you're a camera operator moving through that, it's harder. And keeping the cameras warm from shutting down, and, you know, the whole thing, and the limited daylight, and then shooting out there at night is when it's really cold. So, yeah, I mean, that was just kind of a part of it that we embraced and knew, like, hey, this is going to be intense, but
did everyone embrace it?
Really fun. What's that?
Did everyone embrace it?
Well, no, you know, they would curse me sometimes. I know Justin Chu Carey sometimes, you know, this guy's from California. He grew up in Oakland. He's like, he would often say to me, what the hell are you doing to me, man? And, but we have, there was a great spirit amongst this cast and crew. You know, everyone really bought in, and you can't really pull things off in the way that I feel like we did without just having an incredible team. And I know it can sound like a cliche when people say that, but it's really the truth. And I've worked with good crews, and I've worked with not so great crews. And then this crew, which was an incredible one, this cast and crew, and you just can pull off so much more with them, and it changes your ambition level. I mean, our camera operator, Wes Mirren, is really one of the best handheld camera operators I've ever seen in my life. And he can do things with a camera running at full speed, holding it in front of him, a heavy camera. He's so strong, yet he's also has such finesse that he really informed the look of this show with our DP, Yaron Levy, and Wes Mirren. I mean, when you have a camera department like that, you can do shots like this. If I didn't have them, there's no way we would shoot it this way. So it's really the talent of the personnel involved with this that allowed us to take these kind of chances and stage shots and stage things like that. And I would also say Adrian Young, our stunt coordinator, doing this kind of action and these, you know, portraying this kind of violence with that level of intensity really requires a stunt team that is not just tough, but also incredibly skilled at doing that in a safe way. And keeping everybody safe, but being able to do things repeatedly and over, it takes some really, really talented people. So I just had the finest crew I've ever worked with on this show.
Yeah. So since between season one and season two, we had a global pandemic. Which therefore mirrors some events, you know, we certainly have that argument of, you know, people with different priorities, and you could see arguments on either side as to keep the business open, close the business, mask, no, all this other stuff. But there are also little things that we saw. For example, Rose has an awful, awful haircut in this season. And that's maybe a thing that we wouldn't have been thinking of before. And how did this, where did this filming take place in terms of the pandemic? Was it before, after, a little bit of both? How did it inform your shooting? How do you think it might inform a season three, if there is a season three, besides the fact that it's probably going to be set in Bermuda, if your cast has any plans?
It's a good point. I'm already thinking of that. Interestingly enough, we started shooting in January of 2020. We were shut down in mid-March of 2020. We went into post-production during that time, just editing and doing sound and VFX and music of what we'd shot so far. And then we were one of Netflix's first shows to go back. End of July, early August, we went back and shot straight through October. So we were really, this was my experience of the pandemic was a full year of Black Summer. And in many ways, when we went back, I was certainly nervous about, I didn't want to resume the show if we couldn't do it the way we'd been doing it before, in terms of how we shot the show. And to Netflix's credit, they spared no expense on their COVID protocols. We had incredibly strict COVID protocols, you know, and weeks of quarantine and, you know, zones. And we had an entire department that was devoted to COVID. And, that was, of everyone I've talked to, we had the most strict COVID protocols of anything I've heard. That being said, because we had such a strong COVID team, and because everyone was very responsible, not only with PPE, but also really keeping themselves in check when they weren't at work, we were able to shoot the show the way we shot the show, which was, A, this is a handheld show. This is a very intimate show in terms of the camera is very close to the actors, and the actors are, you know, often engaged physically with each other in very intimate ways. What I was very pleased to find was that we didn't have to change at all what was happening in front of the camera. That was never compromised, but it took more time to get it done. And we had to, you know, the protocols would lead to situations where, you know, you couldn't have the hair. Usually when an actor in between takes, hair, makeup, and wardrobe all immediately hit that actor, and they're adding, you know, fixing their hair and addressing their makeup and the wardrobe, and they're all doing it at the same time. During the pandemic, we couldn't do it. It had to be individually, each one of them deal with the person in a different space. So it added a lot of time. And all of that said, I think the bigger thing was that, you know, psychologically, this was kind of hanging over us the whole time. And I think we felt incredibly grateful that we were working while this was going on. I mean, that's what struck me, was I couldn't believe that I had a job, quite frankly, and that I could go back and actually do that job and we could finish it. If this was, you know, any number of other years I've had, I would have had no work. But because Netflix was really supporting us and behind keeping this going, we all had this incredible opportunity to work through this and prove that it could be done. And we didn't, not a single person got sick on our show. Which was another point of pride for all of us, that we ran a very safe set and did it right. And yeah, it was more effort, but that's okay. You know, it was absolutely worth it. And then, yeah, of course, what's happening in the world is always informs what's happening in the show. And that's probably anyone who's doing movies or TV. So I do feel like, even before the pandemic, I feel like this season, if I look at this season and think about it, I do feel it was very informed by the kind of anger and hostility that has been happening in our country in terms of very deep divisions between people and between families that are part of, you know, a political climate that we've been dealing with for several years. So I feel like Black Summer was in many ways reflected that, not necessarily in an overt intentional way, but a lot of it seeped into it. You know, a lot of those episodes are microcosms of that, because it comes down to trust. You know, it's trust and distrust in your fellow man, distrust in your neighbor, distrust in your family, you know, these kinds of things that have divided us that shouldn't be dividing us, but we have, you know, but life in the 21st century and our relationship to technology and social media and these things have created a kind of rancor, you know, amongst us. And it's something we need to learn from. It's something we need to learn that, you know, that the technology that has assisted us in our life has also led to us kind of living in our own bubbles a little bit. And I think that's been a harmful thing. And I think it's something that we will get through because we will learn from it. We'll learn from our mistakes. And then the pandemic, it almost just raised those questions again, right? Because suddenly we're all faced with something very challenging, and yet we still aren't able to get on the same page. It doesn't mean that we ultimately aren't able to, but we struggle. And I think all those things are reflected in the show. I think that's the cool thing about genre storytelling, is that, you know, in genre storytelling, you can talk about, you know, society, and you can make sociological statements about the state of humanity, and you can do it through horror or science fiction. You know, in many ways, it's a better delivery device to me than just doing it in a straight kind of drama or maybe a story that is overtly about politics is maybe not the right way to deliver those messages. So COVID and the pandemic when I think about this season of this show, that's always going to be a big part of it.
Dude. Now, an interesting thing with season one to season two is that Anna is finally found, as that was the de facto goal of pretty much all the characters, since they were directly or indirectly part of Rose's group, and that was Rose's goal. So this season we meet Anna, and for the first six episodes, she's a cipher, quiet, someone that is more a shadow following her mother. But then the lodge happens, episode 7, and this is her episode from beginning to end, even if there are perspectives of some other characters in it. And we begin to see the development of her character, a young woman growing up in a crazy world where she believes folks like Spears and Son are part of her family. And as a result, from what happens to her and the so-called de facto family, she grows up really quick and maybe with the wrong lessons. What can you tell us about her as a character and what she has become from that little girl we saw in episode 1, season 1?
Yeah. So Anna's played by Zoe Martlett, who is a very talented actress that I had the pleasure of working with. And yeah, season 1, in many ways, Anna is kind of like the Private Ryan of season 1, right? That she's, you know, everyone has to go down to save this one person. And I thought she, right off the bat, was posed a lot of interesting questions. Number one is, you know, is the idea of finding your child in this chaotic world and what that would be about. But the next scariest thing, the next thing that would be just as scary would be trying to keep your daughter alive in this environment. Actually being around her would be almost just as nerve-wracking as trying to find her. And couple that with the idea that this is a girl who is now a teenager and going through adolescence. And what happens with a kid who is, you know, during this time where you are going through your own personal journey and kind of need to identify yourself outside of your parents, you know, that's a tumultuous time in a kid's life, no matter what. Now imagine putting them in wartime, essentially, which is what she's in. And what my thought about Anna is that in season 2 she would be like a child soldier in the Sudan. You know, this would be a kid that is seen war from a very young age, and the question that hangs over the character is, has she been destroyed by this trauma? Has she been turned into a monster? Has she been destroyed by the influence of her mother, who is doing everything she can to save her, but also exposing her to incredibly ruthless behavior? What kind of impact is that making on this kid? And I thought episode 7 and the whole season is kind of leading up to that, which is what has happened to this child and what has she become? And in episode 7, we sort of play that. The idea is that has she herself become a monster, or has something else happened? And I thought that Zoe did a beautiful job with that story. And yes, this would be a spoiler alert, but that, you know, the story I you know, in some early incarnations we wanted to tell, we thought that the story might be that she's become a monster. But ultimately, that's not the story I wanted to tell. I wanted to show that perhaps this kid, and maybe that's a statement about perhaps just future generations, you know, are always going to be able to display some wisdom that maybe we're not able to, you know, and that maybe she is intelligent enough and self-aware enough to understand that while her mother has not always behaved necessarily in a way that she wants to be like, she understands her mother. And then in fact, she makes a decision at the end of that episode that we believe is the behavior of a monster. And it's not till we get to the ending of that episode that we realize oh, she was actually making the adult decision and she was doing something selfless, and that maybe that's where this story is going. And that was kind of, again, another spoiler alert, but the end of their story in episode 8 is she's literally in the driver's seat of a car while her mother and, you know, and Ray are in a Mexican standoff, you know, and that maybe she has to, maybe her role is to be the adult, which is a role that we all, you know, at a certain point, we all have to kind of, with our own parents, when our own parents reach, you know, become very elderly, it's up to the child to become the parent in a sense. And in the case of this, she just has to face that at a very young age, you know, that everything is advanced a lot faster in terms of the aging process for all of them. And they have to, she has to grow up a lot faster. And maybe she's reached that point where it's up to her to be the adult.
That silent scream scene with her is amazing. I love that scene.
That was awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, yeah, because it showed her internalization without actually screaming out loud. And I could see myself or any person in a situation that is overwhelmed doing something like that without actually blowing their cover by doing, actually screaming out, you know? So that was great. Barrett, what do you got?
So we've kind of talked about, hey, we hope there's a season 3. What are our odds of a season 3?
To be honest, I have no idea. We don't know yet. That's a decision Netflix will make, and they won't make it. I don't even know when they would make it. They usually take a month to gather all the data they need to gather in terms of viewership and reception and all of those things. And then they weigh their options. So I have no idea. I certainly would be all, you know, would be, if there was a season 3, I'd be excited to do it. I'd be thrilled. But I also felt like in finishing this season, I even though it doesn't wrap everything up in a bow and answer everything, I wanted to make sure that we weren't left with any contrived cliffhangers. You know, I always imagine, you know, I did season 1 as if it would be the last season, and I did season 2 with a similar mentality. I wanted the story to feel rather complete. And if there was another season, then there's places to go with it. But if there isn't another season, I feel like we did tell a fairly complete story with all of them. So there's, you know, I have no idea if we'll be doing another one. It would be interesting. And we'd have to think long and hard about exactly what we would do with it. I have some ideas, but they're still very general at this point.
Well, again, Netflix has a history of canceling shows after the third season.
Yeah.
So please stick with that mindset of no cliffhangers if you do happen to get a third season.
No, I absolutely know that. I know all the contracts, you know, and everything change after season 3. And quite frankly, to me, 3 seems like a good number. You know, you have a beginning, middle, end. I think that if there was a season 3, I think we would definitely be pretty conclusive with it. I don't know that I when I first went into this, I imagined. Well, when I first went into it, I honestly thought I was going to just do one season. But the conditions for doing season 2 seem so great, and Netflix is so nice to work with that I was excited to do it. But I have felt that for me, at most, I got 3 in me for this, and 3, and that we would really want to kind of close the book on some things at the end of this season. If we did a third.
Nice. I was actually hoping that you would say that the reason you're in Utah doing the shoots is for season 3, to be honest. But.
Yeah, I know. It would be great. I mean, but no, I'm doing a feature right now here in Utah, but Yeah, and the truth is, you know, I never was really interested in doing multiple seasons of stuff because it's always more fun to just switch it up. But last season was a really incredible experience just because of this group, you know, just this amazing crew that I love working with, and cast and Netflix are just so supportive that I've never really had an experience quite like that. It was the most freedom I've ever had to just, you know, it was the most support I've ever had by a studio and the best creative team around me. So part of me is itching to get back with that group. Whether if it wasn't Black Summer, then I would want to do something else with that group for sure.
Right, right. Yeah. There's some interesting characters I noticed in the show are the lucky ones. Basically, I've always said for these dystopian films, the survivors aren't necessarily the strongest or smartest, but mostly where you are or what time you figure out there's actually a problem that those people are actually diseased, stay away, and so forth. So the strongest and smartest won't maybe clueless, and then they just get taken out, while the ones that aren't can survive. So Lance and Boone are two individuals that, though different intellects and characteristics, are ones that appear not to be survivor type. And Boone especially, because it's season two, an interesting character because he generally stays away from people intentionally, almost with common sense. And therefore, when the uproars of violence occur, he's generally safe. And only at a certain time does he show himself when he thinks he can trust someone. Could you explain the Boone character a lot? Because he was an interesting character and someone that I think you're rooting for. And, you know, without saying spoilers.
Yeah, you know, that in the case of the Boone character, it was the idea of creating a character again that, when we first see him, we view him as a threat just because we present him as the kind of just the guy upstairs that you didn't know about. And then he's the guy with the axe. And then you're forced to determine through the eyes of Rose, is this guy someone who's going to help me? Or is he someone who's going to take advantage of me? Is he someone who's going to hurt me? Is he telling the truth? Is he lying? And so I wanted a character that kind of rode that line of, while he doesn't immediately strike you as a major physical threat, he does strike you as maybe someone who's maybe playing loose with the truth. You're not sure. And really playing that storyline in episode six out of Rose being kind of led out into the woods with this guy and her daughter with the promise of something. And when he starts to feel like he's not telling the truth, what is her mindset at this time now? With going through what she's gone through, what do you do with a person like this? Do you let him survive? Do you have to kill him? What are your choices? And what's the smart move in terms of, if you're looking at everyone as either a help or a threat? If they're not a help, are they a threat? So I kind of wanted him to be a way of illustrating this binary thinking that people would start entering into. And then, you know, in so many ways with Black Summer, and especially this season, but even in season one, there's a lot of characters that on the page were somewhat undefined. And it was really about bringing actors in and seeing what they might do with the character. So there was a lot of kind of space to create these characters for the actors because they were fairly undefined in many ways. And in some cases, like with Christine Lee, who played Sun, I mean, that character was not really supposed to be a very big character, and she wasn't intended to survive at all in season one. But Christine brought some just an incredible spirit, and she's just such a talent that I suddenly started to become a lot more intrigued by this character. And the possibilities. And so in the case of Boone, in many way, Manuel Rodriguez, who played that character, you know, Manny came in with this take on the character that was very different than what we had written. And he, there's something very lovable about him and very charming and very bizarre in his take too. I mean, he played this character as his own kind of, there's definitely a weirdness to the guy, and he's kind of talking to himself, and you can't tell if he's, you know, kind of dangerously crazy or just kind of eccentric, but there's a sweetness to him as well. And there's something about him that you want to just kind of take care of him. And so much of that was what the performer brought. And then we started writing to that. And I did the same thing in season two that I did in season one, which is I didn't write the final episode until we were more than halfway through shooting. I wanted to leave it open so that I could gather the data of what's happening here, and in many ways so that these characters can take on lives of their own. And in season two, there's a number of characters who were never intended to survive early episodes who started to become interesting characters, and that really informed how the whole thing ended. So he was an example of that, and there are a number of examples of that. I mean, Jesse Lipscomb, who plays the Mance character, again, that was a much smaller character originally, and Jesse just brought something really interesting to the table that made me want to see how this journey played out with this guy. So that was another one of the big joys of doing this show is kind of putting a team of actors together and seeing, you know, the show in many ways is there's a lot of careful planning, and in some ways it's a very tight construction in terms of how these shots go together, and those, like that whole bit with Lance at the beginning, these takes months of planning and lots of different days of shooting and lots of departments. But at the same time, I also like to keep it really loose and rewrite scenes on the day and let actors really inform what happens with their characters. So in many ways, those characters become much more than what the original idea was.
Yeah, I can see that, and some of the other great characters was like Braithwaite and other characters. I mean, he was an awesome character. That was, if the Lodge didn't happen, I think that would have been my favorite episode. Actually, that was really great. And then the whole thing with the house they find and stuff. Never mind the main plot between the two. Well, we've kept you for a good amount of time. We appreciate it, and I'm sure we could keep you for even longer. But obviously, we don't want to do that because we want you to come back another time sometime, and we don't want to see like we're abusing you. So, do you want to talk a little bit about Sick? I mean, is it something that you know you worked with Kevin Williamson? That's pretty impressive. Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that. You know, that came about fairly quickly working with Kevin. He was a fan of Alone, and he reached out to me with a script that he had written. That is a, you know, what I'll say is it's actually a very contemporary horror thriller that is, it's actually a pandemic. It takes place during, you know, April of 2020. And it's a Kevin Williamson slasher film set at that time. And I was really fascinated with the idea of taking Kevin's kind of style of storytelling where, you know, his scripts are built on such intentional architecture. Where there's, you know, he's such a student of the genre. So there is so many kind of setups and payoffs, and there's not a wasted word in the script. And it's a, you know, like I say, a very tight construction. And he also has a real kind of pop sensibility of a story that's very of the moment with young people. And it really is very much kind of diving into the slasher genre and taking all, in many ways, taking all of the tropes of the genre and putting an intelligent spin on those things. And I thought the idea of taking that and telling that story with my own approach, which is a much more kind of grounded, naturalistic take on things, that there might be a really interesting chemistry there. So it was an opportunity to try something that I hadn't done before. And like I said, I still have another few more days of shooting. It'll be really interesting to see how that all comes together and what the ultimate tone of it is. But we have some terrific actors in this. Gideon Adlon is the star, and Beth Million, who's a wonderful new discovery, and some really talented, more recognizable faces that I probably can't give away. They play some of the bad guys, but but it's been a real challenging one, quite frankly, but a fun challenge, and we'll see how it all turns out.
Excellent. All right, great. If you want to let folks know where they can find you on social media or anything like that, or
I'm at J.R. Himes on Twitter. I'm pretty bad with social media, to be honest. I read it more than I post on it, but yeah, that's about it. But yeah, like I say, I invite anyone to check out season two of Black Summer. We certainly I'm really proud of it, and I think if you are a fan of any kind of if you're a fan of horror, suspense, or zombies alone, I think, you know, or just survival thrillers, I think we kind of combine all those elements in this.
You should be proud. It was brilliant.
Yeah,
thank you very much.
Yeah, it was the best TV I've seen since Game of Thrones, to be honest.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you guys very much. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely, my friend. And we'll definitely want to get you back on when Sick comes out so you can talk about that if you're interested. So
I'd love to, anytime.
All right, or Black Summer Season 3.
Yeah.
Let's hope.
I am. Jeez. Trust me.
Yeah, same here. All right. Well, appreciate it, Sean. You take care, and have a good night. And I guess you're going to work tonight, right?
So. You're about to go to work in about half an hour, so yes.
All right. Take care now.
Take care, everyone. Thank you. Have a good one.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. So that was John Himes, director of the movie Alone, as well as the showrunner, show creator of Black Summer 1 and 2, and hopefully a season 3, as you said, Barrett. And then, of course, he's now working on a project called Sick, written by the great Kevin Williamson, who wrote such great films as Scream. Mike, what was your thoughts?
I thought he's very long, detailed, thoughtful answers. He's unbelievably generous with his time. I think he has a great take on the zombie genre. You know, I've always said that one of the reasons why the zombie genre is popular is because the monsters are often incidental. That's about the people.
And yet, in this show, he has as many zombies as people, which is awesome.
Yeah, well, I also there's little Easter eggs, little things like, when you're in the mansion, for four episodes, there's only one zombie outside. It's the same zombie through all four. And I didn't pick that up, on my first viewing. But he also has a lot of people, when they die, they, turn very quickly. And so a lot of the actors get to become zombies, too.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, which is all part of the trope. But no, he is doing different things with it, right? And doing things in a way that is very grounded, as you said. You can either do things in a heightened way or in a grounded way. Well, Walking Dead often does things in a very heightened way. And so you have, a woman walking around with samurai swords and children pulling off headshots of zombies and stuff like that, because that's the video game fun aspect of being in the apocalypse. And then you get the scariest shit, oh my god, what am I going to do if I don't have any food and any heat in the middle of winter? Reality aspect of the zombie apocalypse.
Right.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I really liked about this season is that the zombies, while fast, the fights are so realistic. Like, people are trying to fight them off and not get bit, but they're not really doing well against them. You know, they're trying everything they can to get them off. And it just shows you how powerful they are, like, in coming against human.
Barrett, like the director said, you know, how easy is it really to shoot a moving target in the head with a pistol, you know, or something? You know, it's almost impossible. And so yeah, they played it up, as John Hyman said, as realistic as possible. You know,
and you can't stop them. So bullets to the torso don't stop them. Then they're in range and you have to fight them because they're fast. So if you do miss the head, you're in trouble.
yeah, you definitely are. So the series is absolutely fantastic series. Season one and season two, there's all different characters in each season, but they are linked together. And some of the main characters is carry over, and so definitely check out season one before you watch season two. I haven't seen the first season for sure.
And if you're at all unsure, if for some reason you've skipped it, most of the episodes are well under an hour.
Yep.
There's a number of episodes that are only 30 minutes, and I think the finale for season one is only like 20 minutes, 22 minutes.
Yeah, exactly.
But I think if you're looking to see what I would compare this to, I would probably go with something like 28 Days Later. Is probably without the infectious component. This is just a thing: when you die, you become a zombie. Bit, not bit, doesn't really matter. But I think that would probably be the closest thing I could come to. But even then, that was much more of a lone person surviving, and where here you're still in, like, as you always like, Phil, the immediate decay of civilization, especially in the first season.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And every episode is very tightly written, so that's really nice too. So you don't really have, you know, wasted moments.
And I really do recommend, once you watch season two, if not right away, go back and rewatch it, because there are a lot of rewarding things, like a Tarantino film where the story structure is sort of pretzel-y, you know, it curves in on itself. Especially those first four episodes. It becomes a little bit more linear after episode four, where there's a lot of things, though, in those first four episodes that tie in, and so many things come fast, it's easy to lose track of some of the new characters and how certain characters are introduced, and then realizing that's actually a payoff to a thing that'll happen in episode three. And yeah, it's and really just how many little things are connected. And so few characters are formally introduced. Right. You're just, you don't realize that, oh, they were there in the background in that shot in episode two, or and really most of the characters I just identified by their costumes.
Yes, it's the jacket. I was telling Phil that the only way I recognized each guy was by the jacket.
and the women
too, honestly.
It took me a little bit to figure out Tears and Sun. I mean, the only one that was obvious was Rose, but everybody else. Yeah, I mean, it took me a bit to figure out who was who, because everybody's bundled up and covered. All their hair is grown out, beards are grown out, you know, so everybody looks different from season one. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was Spears until we got to like episode three or four, I think. Whenever it was, it mentioned his name. I was like, oh wait, that was him. Same thing with Lance. I did not realize that was Lance until I think it was on the rewatch, and I rewatched it with subtitles on. Yeah. I think it said his name. It was like, oh, whoops.
Right. Yeah. It is kind of funny how that works. All right. Anything else anybody wanted to bring up before we start wrapping it up?
No, all just right, that I good. Highly suggest this season.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic television series. And I think both me and you, Barrett, were honest when we said it was some of the best TV that we've ever seen. And I know, Mike, you love it, and you were the one that recommended it to me in the first place. So yeah, it's a great show. All right, so I guess we can wrap it up. So Mike, why don't you lead us out?
All right, well, thank you for joining John Hyams and your three hosts for this episode of Dark Discussions. We hope you enjoyed it. We hope you found it informative. And if you are not a Black Summer fan, we strongly encourage you to watch it and then come back and listen to the podcast again. Otherwise, please tune into the next episode of Dark Discussions, where we will be discussing something else, something probably Taylor Swift related.